What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. In Xanadu, did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree? What films will we decree to be the 10 greatest ever? Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune is here to help us complete our craziest mission yet. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Amen.
Are you ready for this?
I am. I'm ready.
Well, this is going to be a star-studded affair, not only because we have Michael, but also because we invited a few guests to call in with their number one most essential movie. Basically, with a list like this, we need some other people to take the heat.
That's right.
We're also going to play Adam's conversation with one of our favorite up-and-coming filmmakers, discussing his all-time top 10.
All that and more ahead on this special two-part episode of Film Spotting. Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
And by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free. Join now at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Hey, Film Spotting fans.
Which, by the way, includes my girlfriend who listens to Film Spotting, but not so much to our podcast.
Which is called How to Do Everything. I'm Mike.
And I'm Ian. And our show, How to Do Everything, is half survival guide, half advice show.
We take your questions and we find experts to answer them.
Everything from how to find water in the desert to how to ask out a coworker at the office without it getting weird.
Or maybe your girlfriend doesn't listen to your podcast. We can try and help with that, too.
That one's impossible.
Have you asked her?
I've tried to play it into her ears while she's sleeping.
Did it work?
She talked about nightmares. She talked about the nightmare she had.
Yeah. Whatever your question, check us out at howtodoeverything.org.
You can subscribe for free on iTunes. Or if you have a how-to question for us, send it to howto@npr.org.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips is here with us as well. Inspired by Sight and Sound's recent revelation of the top 10 greatest films of all time, as voted on separately by several hundred critics and directors, we're sharing our personal desert island lists.
You believe I love you?
Yes.
And if you lose me, then you'll know I loved you and I wanted to go on loving you.
I won't lose you.
Let me go into the church alone. Why?
Guys, of course, the big news from the 2012 critics poll was that film, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, taking over the top spot from Citizen Kane. Kane had been number one every decade since 1962. Last week here on the show, we posed a Sight and Sound Greatest Films poll deathmatch. We asked listeners to choose one or the other, and I figured this seems as good a place to start as any since one of these two masterpieces was the only film that made all three of our top 10 lists. So, Josh, how did the poll come out?
The listeners voted for Citizen Kane. They held firm with 54%, but Vertigo was not far behind, 46%.
I have to say, I thought Citizen Kane would win, but I thought it would win by a little bit of a higher margin. Are you surprised at all, Michael, to see it that close?
It's the reverse of the Cubs, guys. I mean, you know, the Cubs can never win, and for decades, Kane could never lose. And in a way, it's just sort of asking to be dethroned. You know, you can't have a four-term president anymore, and you can't have, this is so really what you're doing is we're not doing the Sight and Sound poll. We're kind of doing the smell and taste poll.
That's kind
of what we're up to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, listeners chose Kane and we did as well. Before we talk about how we approached our lists and really dive into our picks, let's go ahead and spend a little bit of time on Citizen Kane. Since it was our lone unanimous selection, Michael, why Citizen Kane?
This film for so many people was the film that they fell in love with at a certain age, you know, maybe some teen year of their, you know, form, you know, the adolescent formation. And it's the first film I think a lot of people were really spellbound by, but they couldn't really tell you why. It's not really because it's a gripping mystery, although there is a riddle at the heart of it. But there's something about the theatricality and the cinematic bravura of it. It's just more of a dazzlement than anybody you know I knew at age 14 or 15 had seen. It's you take such delight in the way it was made, and It's very different from Vertigo, the one that's deposed Citizen Kane, in that there's certainly Hitchcock's filmmaking is scarcely less bravura than many of his other films, but that film is fundamentally much simpler and sadder and more seriously troubling in a way. And mm-hmm. Kane, you can just kind of dive into as a cinematic wonder, and I'm a little sad to see it off the number one.
Are you?
Personally, much as I love Vertigo, much as the whole question of which Hitchcock to pick, if you really had to pick one, I mean, talk about a vexation, guys, a vexation. I was vexed.
That question alone, huh?
I'm still vexed, actually.
I think Kane persists because it's such a thrilling textbook. I mean, it's elemental cinema, so you can look at it and learn about how the movies were maybe not born, but at least perfected, possibly, or certainly techniques were pioneered and perfected. And yet, at the same time, you can get absolutely lost in the story and the theatricality of it and the performances, so that it's fun while when you come to it the first time as a film student or whatever, it's fun, yet you're learning everything you need to know about the cinema at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you used the word mystery, Michael, because as I was looking over my list after I'd come up with my 10 selections, I was looking through them to see if there was some commonality, if there was a thread running through them at all. And one of the themes I settled on, or one of the concepts I clued in on, was the fact that all of these films on my list, and I'm sure it runs throughout some of your picks as well, really are driven by a mystery. It isn't necessarily a mystery in the sense that you're trying to solve a crime or even trying to solve a puzzle, though some of my picks do fall into that as well. But really, it's filmmakers exploring the when, the how, and most importantly, the why of human behavior, really dealing with some fundamental existential questions. And the central mystery here with Kane is, of course, Rosebud, trying to unlock the significance of that dying gasp and what insights we can take away, if any, about this larger-than-life figure. There's so much going on narratively. It's, of course, matched by what's going on technically. But what's driving it all is that central quest, that mystery that the newsreel reporter is trying to get to the bottom of.
If you could have found out what that Rosebud meant, I bet that would have explained everything.
No, I don't think so. Mr. Kane was a man who got everything he wanted and then lost it. Maybe Rosebud was something he couldn't get or something he lost. Anyway, it wouldn't have explained anything. I don't think any word can explain a man's life. No, I guess Rosebud is just a piece in a jigsaw puzzle. A missing piece.
I do wonder, Orson Welles was the first to kind of dismiss his own the screenplay with Herman Mankiewicz. The central idea of that is kind of I think he called it penny ante Freud or something. Very dismissive about the whole, oh, what's the key to the guy's life, uh-huh. Rose, blah, blah, blah. But
almost as if it's a MacGuffin in his own.
Yeah.
And he has a line at one point where he says you can't describe a whole man's life with
right.
one word.
And,
so.
And of course the film's hinged on it, but that's a great paradox of it. I think the other thing I remember really kind of guiding a lot of the debates about that film when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, first really falling in love with it and wanting to see it again and again, is it really divided all kinds of serious, you know, serious teenage moviegoers in Racine, Wisconsin, anyway, where I fell in love with it. Because for half the people I knew, Citizen Kane was and probably still remains simply a little too cold to the touch to be an object that they truly love mm-hmm. and revisit. Because it's the temperature of that film is cool. It's not trying to be loved. And it's not trying to make you love the, you know, this forbidding central character. It's just not it's not about that. And I think if you tell people who have never seen Citizen Kane that this film is essentially, as Pauline Kael described it once, a newspaper comedy. Okay, they go in sort of expecting, okay, it's kind mm-hmm. of this impudent, brash, kaleidoscopic, kind of oddly structured biography of a guy who's a little like William Randolph Hearst, but essentially it's kind of a dark comedy about ambition and a hollow man. And blah, blah, blah. I think you're going to get a very different, because I think people kind of bring a whole load afraid of, okay, prove it, number one, always
right.
on the, you're always number
sure.
one on the site
yeah.
ensemble. And it's just, the film doesn't really weigh all that it has its own, it's in a different weight class. I it makes me love it no less. And I mean, Welles to me is one of the three or four directors that mean everything to me.
When you say cool to the touch, I think that's because it has a cynicism that was certainly in the immediate years after it came out not of its time in how it portrays the American success, the American dream, the dark side of that. And the country wasn't maybe ready for that, certainly in the years after World War II. But now it does seem to have a resonance and maybe started to have one since, what, the 60s, I think you said, Adam, is when it was number one. And certainly through the 70s, I think that probably resonated and still does today, where we see this picture of the beginning of the decline of America, if Kane does represent American success. And certainly that still seems to hold true today.
Well, I'm guessing there are some people listening to us right now who remain unconvinced, who've seen it and maybe found it a little bit cold to the touch, think that maybe our choice and the fact that it's number two on the critics list in Sight and Sound magazine is a little bit boring, a little bit too predictable. If you are one of those people who don't think maybe Kane is still as relevant as it once was, here's the writer-director of the movie Brick, The Brothers Bloom, and the upcoming Looper, Ryan Johnson, to tell you otherwise.
Hey, guys. This is Ryan Johnson calling in to talk about my most essential film. So I think one kind of unfortunate side effect of canonizing a group of movies, especially when it's from a really when it's a really prestigious group that's doing it, is it can kind of tend to lend a layer of dust to some of them. And so I want to make a very personal and passion case for Citizen Kane actually being my most essential movie on that list and of all time, especially maybe for some, if you got younger listeners who are mostly familiar with Kane from lists like that. You know, Citizen Kane is an incredibly vital film, and it's a movie that every time I'm sitting down to storyboard a project, the first thing I do is I sit down and I rewatch Kane, because visually, the same way that Goodfellas is an essential text for editing, Kane is an essential text for me, at least, for visual composition. And the things that Wells was doing with his frames, the way he created depth, the way he brought everything to life, is done not only so well, but with so much exuberance and panache, and he just goes out on limbs visually. But if you study the frames and study the way that he blocks his shots, it really is just a master class, and it's as vibrant as you can possibly imagine. And Wells was in his mid-20s when he made this movie. This is really, it has the leading part of a young man's movie. And it's storytelling-wise, it goes out on it takes huge risks in the way it structures its story and the way it tells it, but it's still riveting from front to back in ways that, you know, movies are still trying to capture that lightning in the bottle today. And it's also just very emotionally resonant. Again, it has just this incredible passion to it. That's backed up by form. Anyway, that's why Citizen Kane is still the top of the heap for me. And I'm not saying anything new, but that's it for me. Thank you so much, guys, and I look forward to talking soon.
Our thanks to Ryan Johnson, a longtime friend of the show. I thought the most interesting thing Ryan had to say there was the fact that every time he approaches a new project, he sits down and watches Citizen Kane. He looks for inspiration every time he starts a new film from Citizen Kane. Certainly does speak to the fact that this movie is still very relevant for filmmakers today. We're not quitting Kane just yet. Ryan wasn't alone among our guests in choosing Citizen Kane as his most essential film.
Hey, Film Spotter, this is Matt Singer from Film Spotting SVU, and while it may not be the most glamorous or exciting pick, and it may have been dethroned by Vertigo in Sight and Sound's greatest film poll, for me, the most essential movie of all time still is Citizen Kane. And I saw it for the first time as a teenager. It basically changed the way I looked at movies, and that changed my life. And I've still not gotten tired of watching it over and over. I like to say, you know, it's not really even the best movie ever. It's basically every movie ever, you know. It's a comedy, it's a tragedy, it's a drama, it's a farce, it's a biopic, it's even a little bit of a musical. And all that stuff is all rolled into this one amazing, technically fascinating package. So when you say essential movies, to me that's got to be number one. If there's one movie that every self-respecting cinephile has to see, I mean, it's got to be Citizen Kane, right? Take care, guys.
Thank you, Matt. And if you haven't subscribed yet to Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit, we do encourage you to do so. It's available through iTunes, or you can grab the RSS feed from filmspottingsvu.com. That's a really interesting point. that Matt makes, it gets back to what you were saying, Michael, about it being maybe essentially a newspaper comedy, this notion that in some way it sums up every movie or all of American cinema, it being a comedy, a tragedy, drama, a farce, all of those things, including, of course, a biopic.
And I think this is why people who are brand new to it, say young college students who may or may not have a strong interest in film, it's a perplexing film. And God love any movie that can still perplex a new generation, like four generations mm-hmm. later, four or five generations later. I think it sort of made me think about what in the top five in the Sight and Sound poll kind of makes runs a through line between those five. And really, you know, three out of the five at least didn't really find a strong audience and essentially didn't make its money back or, you know, in the first pass. It's just a good reminder to, especially in this box office crazed time where we just, you know, look at the, well, who won, quote, won the box office over the weekend. You know, it's these things come and go, and movies like Kane stay.
Well, now that workers of the world have united for Kane, or at least film critics and filmmakers have united, let's move on to the rest of our list. And I think this has to be, Josh, I was telling you before we sat down, I think it's the biggest challenge we've ever faced on the show, because every week with our top five lists, we come up with rules, we come up with restrictions, we find ways to limit down things that are already limited by the fact that they all fall into a certain genre or a theme or have some kind of connective tissue can make those picks.
We try to find ways to avoid exactly this.
Exactly. Yeah. And here we have to choose from every film we've ever seen. This is thousands of movies for each of us. Obviously, it's very hard. And here's how Nick James, the Sight and Sound editor, presented the challenge to the different voters. He said, you might choose the 10 films you feel are most important to film history, or the 10 that represent the aesthetic pinnacles of achievement, or indeed the 10 films that have had the biggest impact on your own view of cinema. Michael, did you do any of those things or something different?
All three of those and a little something. I mean, it's all subjective, God knows, but I like your word essential, Adam, because to me, greatest implies kind of an Encyclopedia Britannica objectivity, or I think if you just took this list and made it, quote, most influential films, then you're almost in a weird way carving away your deep personal connection to the picture. So it's really a little of everything. And in a lot of ways, there's directors you really completely convinced need to be in there because of what they mean to you. And my impulses tend to go toward a great director's more modest work in some cases. I wouldn't go that way, because I suppose you could say Kane is, quote, the most influential, and certainly there's one that got him launched and everything else. But, you know, there's films like Touch of Evil, which are completely disreputable and just the greatest B-movie ever made, and everything that are really no less great. So
yeah.
I don't know. I think great is a tricky word. Favorite probably goes a little too far the other way. I like your word essential.
Okay. Josh, are you in the same ballpark there?
The challenge is, how do you make this personal, right? And the way I tried to do that is look at the films that are the most essential and then take away the ones that I respect or appreciate or admire, and leave behind the ones that still thrill me about the potential of cinema. So no matter how old they are, no matter how many times I've seen them, when I watch them again, I finish it and immediately want to go find another movie to watch. Hmm. Sometimes there are films, and one that didn't make my cut, which I greatly appreciate, The Rules of the Game, I just didn't have that visceral response to it, but completely understand why it's on lists. I kept the ones that I did just jump off the couch or out of the theater and want to pursue cinema more after seeing them.
Yeah, that jump off the couch moment, I'm calling it that transcendent moment. These have to be transcendent films. I think it goes without saying that the stories have to be compelling. It has to be more than just entertaining, though it also has to be entertaining. But you have to transcend, I think, conventional cinema in some way. These are filmmakers with their work offering something sublime, something mysterious, as we touched on, that you have to contend with, something that makes these films worth coming back to and allows you to wrestle with them every time you watch them. And to steal Werner Herzog's phrase, I was thinking about Herzog and my recent documentary films class, his notion of the ecstatic truth in documentaries. I think there has to be that ecstatic element in these films. One of the ways you get at that ecstatic element is, I think, by saying something really personal and also distinct. And as I was formulating all this in my head last week, I was listening to some podcasts in the car. I was listening to KCRW's The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell, catching up on an old episode with Steven Soderbergh. And Elvis asked him a question about the kind of films he's trying to make now, what's driving his choices. And he said something that really summed up perfectly what I think I'm trying to get at.
Well, that's the trick, is can you build on these pillars in a way that's interesting and doesn't feel old or doesn't feel like a copy? I mean, that's the goal, is how do I make this distinctive? How do I make it specific? How do I make it feel like nobody else would have done it exactly this way? That's you know, when you're growing up and you're first seeing films and starting to watch them for something other than entertainment, it's that thing that starts to emerge. Seeing, you know, Dr. Strangelove when you're 14 and feeling him behind every decision that's on screen, like really feeling it, feeling a singular intelligence behind what you're looking at, makes a gigantic impression. And you begin to notice there's a real difference between movies that have that and movies that don't.
My thanks to Jenny Rattlett and KCRW. You can, of course, check out the show at KCRW.com. But when he was talking about Kubrick and Dr. Strangelove, that really did speak to me in terms of what I was trying to get at with my selections for this list. So I think that personal connection, the fact that you're seeing filmmakers who are making choices that only they would make, and their vision is really clearly coming through, I'm sure that probably is the case with all of our picks. And the way we did this, we organized our remaining picks after Citizen Kane by theme. We tried to come up with some way to group these together because we didn't rank them. Sight and Sound doesn't ask their participants to rank them, so we weren't going to make this any tougher on us than it already is. This first set here falls under the category of voyeurism, main characters who like to watch, and I thought this was fitting for this endeavor, as we essentially do all become voyeurs when we go to the cinema. None of us went with Vertigo, the film that was number one, of course, on the critics' list overall. But Josh and Michael, you both selected another Hitchcock classic for your list.
Go on, pick it up, Thorwald. Go on, you're curious. Come on, you wonder if it's your girlfriend calling, the one you killed for. Go on, pick it up.
That is Rear Window, and I think, Josh, it's appropriate that you start us off, because this is a movie that you've consistently ranked not just in your top 10, but you've said this is your number one favorite film.
Well, you have to have an answer for that question.
You do.
Because it comes so often. And so I was forced into a corner. I thought, what am I going to say? I can't say Citizen Kane, even though it could very well be that film. I got to come up with something a little less expected. And Rear Window felt good to me, really for the reason you touch on, Adam, that it has to do with this sense of voyeurism. Hitchcock's 1954 thriller is a movie about watching others. And it taps into that very voyeurism that drives the cinema. That's the appeal. For me, this is leisurely paced and relatively static for a top movie of all time, I feel. Yet it's really as manipulative as any of Hitchcock films. At least I feel that it is, as I watch it over and over again. Suspicion, paranoia, fear, they're all as palpable here as in any of his films. I think Rear Window's greatness, it lies in the way it echoes the dangerous appeal of the movies themselves to me. We're all peeping Toms when we go to the show. And I think that somewhere underneath Rear Window, the movie is sinisterly tweaking our subconscious guilt about that. And I like that interplay going on.
Of course, I was thinking about Peeping Tom as we were on this subject of voyeurs. Unfortunately, no Powell and Pressburger making any of our lists, which is a shame.
One of them made my 11 through 20.
Okay, well, we will get to the 11 through 20 in our film spotting bonus content.
Right around 11:20, 11:30, we'll probably get to
exactly,
that.
Exactly, as
oh
we finally
goodness,
get
we're
there.
We're doing bonus content on this? You didn't warn me.
We are. Michael, Rear Window, also your selection. So in that very tough question of your favorite Hitchcock, apparently this one won out on this day.
This is the thing that hacked me off the most about this damn assignment. I mean, just wrestling with which is actually greater. I mean, my, you know, Rear Window versus Vertigo versus Psycho versus, you know, the two others I love just as much. Sabotage from his British period, which not enough people know. And Shadow of a Doubt, which is fantastic. The Thornton Wilder script, basically our Tom with a murderer in it. Joseph Cotten's greatest performance.
It's a great film.
That might be his creepiest, actually.
Yeah, no, I really, truly love that film. And I mean, part of me, Josh, just wants to say, yeah, I almost went with Rear Window. And then, but I guess what fascinates me here is that Rear Window and Psycho treat so many of the same themes in such a different way where at first glance you'd think, well, this can't even be the work of the same director, because the tonality and the mood and the crazy kind of, you know, expressionistic extremes of the second one versus this kind of blithe romantic comic trappings of Rear Window. It's just, I don't know. You know, Hitchcock is the kind of director, is the director that so many of us fell in love with, and really he's the one who introduced us to what movies can do to us. And you look at the entire career later, and especially when you look at how many movies of his didn't even get a damn nomination at the Academy Awards, it's just hilarious, you know. And then you know, Rear Window to me was also the first film that made me realize James Stewart is as good an actor that became a movie star as anyone ever saw come out of Hollywood. And I hadn't really acquainted myself with Stewart's best work until I saw Rear Window, and that scene where he's in a sweat watching Grace Kelly about to be nabbed across the way, and there's no music, it's just strictly Stewart in this horrible panic, really almost nonverbal. I mean, it's great, and that's what I go to Hitchcock for. There are moments of anguish that cut right through whatever genre you're dealing with, whatever kind of you know, entertaining suspense happens to be going on, or just kind of gut grinding, whatever suspense. And it just gets to something very dark and painful. And then sort of you're out of it again. And that's why he's such a master.
Well, I certainly love your defenses of Rear Window, the case you make for that film. I guess this is one where I probably fall into line with the majority of film critics, at least the ones who voted in the Sight and Sound poll, and thinking Vertigo is the greater masterpiece. Rear Window seems to me the film that is his most perfect, maybe, and I do really love Rear Window, but Vertigo's the one that has that mystery, those answers that just don't seem to come, that draw you back to it again and again. So I guess I'd probably put Vertigo just slightly higher, but I'm not going to argue against Rear Window. It's such a great film, and I'm going to see your Jimmy Stewart and raise you Kyle MacLachlan spying through the slits in the closet door on the grotesque charade being performed by Dennis Hopper and Isabella Rossellini in David Lynch's movie Blue Velvet. And this was a really tough choice for me because Mulholland Drive is another David Lynch favorite of mine and was a contender for my top 10, but in wrestling with those, I kept coming back to the Lynch film that was, for me, my entree into the art house. There are a lot of noir elements here. This is certainly a legitimate crime mystery where the main character, Jeffrey Beaumont, discovers a severed ear while walking through a vacant lot in what seems to be his idyllic hometown of Lumberton, and he just can't let well enough alone. He becomes a detective. He has to figure out whose ear it is and what the circumstances could be surrounding this act. And every time he unravels one part of the truth, something more terrifying emerges. And speaking of terrifying, I think Dennis Hopper is maybe the scariest screen villain of all time in that movie. There's that scene I've talked about before at the end of the film where he's dressed up as the well-dressed man. He's got the mustache on. Something about when Kyle MacLachlan looks down the stairs and Dennis Hopper just looks up at him with this face that just screams menace. That gets me every time. Literally does give me goosebumps. And as we talk about mystery, I mentioned that kind of running throughout my picks here. How do you explain a sequence like Dean Stockwell lip-syncing to Roy Orbison's In Dreams? You can't explain a sequence like that, at least not in practical terms, but in the abstract, it does fit perfectly, I think, within Lynch's world of corrupted innocence. Think about that great opening sequence to Blue Velvet with the children playing and the dogs barking and the fire trucks going by, but then, of course, we go underneath and we see that severed ear, we see the bugs crawling on it. I think that Lynch's distinction, with all of his stylistic and thematic tropes that we've seen over and over again, is that he takes us underneath the surface into the darkness of the human psyche. And even when he misfires, I'm always fascinated by what Lynch is doing, but here it's definitely the one that I keep coming back to the most.
I close my eyes, then I drift away.
I think Blue Velvet brings up the question of historical context, because when you think of 1986, Hollywood was arguably at the height of its factory production heyday in terms of what was just being churned out for multiplexes. And then it comes Blue Velvet, something that's just astonishing in what it's trying to do and how it's trying to do it. So how much weight do we give? I don't know if you guys did give a lot of weight to the movie's influence at the time of its release. I can't say that I didn't really factor that in.
No, but it does make me think what you're saying of The Squid and the Whale and Jeff Daniels going, Short Circuit or Blue Velvet? We're going to Blue Velvet.
That's it.
I don't care if you're 14 or 10. We're going to Blue Velvet.
That sums it up.
I think Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive, especially Mulholland Drive, really are going to be films that I suspect will just sort of creep up the Sight and Sound poll decade by decade. It seems like Mulholland Drive, I think, is already ranked higher, no?
Yeah, it is. I think it came in somewhere around 28 or something on the list. It was one of the highest recent films on the list.
Yeah, no, I love it. I mean, we, you know, when Tony Scott and I were on At the Movies and we did our best of the decade, Mulholland Drive was that for me. That scene you mentioned, Adam, in Blue Velvet with Dean Stockwell singing In Dreams, I mean, to me, that's one of the scenes that actually dies a little bit on it. Feet. I'm not sure that has the same kind of. It didn't keep me wrapped like so much of the rest of the film did. And for a lot of people, they hadn't seen that kind of fierce irony applied what seems to be a murder mystery, relatively straightforward. Lynch can barely tell that story straight. He does not care. It does not really matter.
No,
you know. I mean, and the expositional stuff in there is very horsey and kind of unconvincing. And It's not why anybody goes to Blue Velvet, but you're not going to really get the mystery solved. You're going because Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern are just incomparably great together as this young couple, and sort of the comically extreme views of budding sexuality and this horribly corroded sexuality that you get with Dennis Hopper and Isabella Rossellini. I mean, that's where the movie's strength and just bizarre power comes from, is just that basically.
You're probably thinking a show about the best movies of all time is too lofty for something as idiotic as Massacre Theater, right? Well, you'd be wrong. Our performances and more of our top 10 all-time greatest films are next. Stay with us. Have you seen my head?
Film Spotting is presented by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod.
Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible has it covered.
And we like to feature listener recommendations of Audible audiobooks worth seeking out. This one comes from Dan Bowen. Manchester via Sydney is where he hails from. He says, check out Imperium by Robert Harris. If you would think the tale of the Senator Cicero's rise to power through the vicious Roman political system would be hard to follow, you would be right. But the story is so compelling and Bill Wallace's narration so perfect that you'll strain every brain cell to try. The best bit is that it's the first in a trilogy. You'll be hooked, Dan says.
We also received this pick from Daryl Mather in Brighton, UK. Given the wave of superhero reviews in the last few weeks, Spidey, Dark Knight, it seemed appropriate for me to recommend Super Gods, what masked vigilantes, miraculous mutants, and a sun god from Smallville can teach us about being human, by Grant Morrison and narrated by John Lee. For me, Grant Morrison is one of the leading modern superhero storytellers, and in this book, Grant draws on history, art, mythology, and his own thoughts and experiences to provide a fascinating history of the superhero universe and much more besides.
That sounds really fascinating.
It does.
I have to say, and it's certainly a mouthful of a title, but it sounds like a really, really interesting book. Yeah. Thank you, Daryl, and thank you, Dan. We love to get your recommendations. You can email us your picks, feedback@filmspotting.net, or go to facebook.com/filmspotting and post them there on our wall. We've been accumulating a few titles, and fortunately, Audible is definitely going to be on board through the month of September, so we'll probably have a chance to get to your recommendations.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
You big shoulders, young one, he who follows.
You speak pretty good American. where I commence. Someone teach you?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's a scene from the John Ford and John Wayne Western, The Searchers, a movie that I wanted to include here briefly, Michael, because it's a film that I'm sure we're going to get some grief in the feedback from listeners who are shocked that we didn't find room for this great film anywhere in our respective top 10 lists. Do you feel any shame about leaving off The Searchers?
Not only do I feel no shame, I'm still wrestling, and I will do to my dying day, I will still be wrestling why I don't think that's even, I mean, it's a key film in Ford's career, and it's such an important film to so many people, but it's got that slight taint of the 10-ton important Western that I resist. It's in the Shane realm, and The Searchers is right in there. I mean, the Westerns that mean something to me tend to be the bantamweight things like the Anthony Mann's, things or our films like 310 to Yuma, Naked Spur a little earlier on. Those are the – and for Ford, I think it's My Darling Clementine. The Searchers to me, I don't know. I have to go to a shrink or something. But I just think for me, I hear all about how complicated and provocative – the racism of that central character played by John Wayne is, for the time, it is, out there further than other films certainly went. And I mean, it's not like Ford lost his pictorial eye on this picture, but it does not, maybe for reasons, Adam and John, maybe for reasons that it took me until I was 35 or 40 to find Westerns I even loved. Any Western, because it was not my genre.
Yeah.
Maybe that's my excuse.
It's a genre I didn't fully come to appreciate until actually starting to do this show and devoting 8 weeks to just watching some of the all-time classic Westerns. And we watched some of the ones you mentioned that maybe aren't in the Valhalla of Westerns. Movies like My Darling Clementine, though that's pretty well-respected. Movies like Winchester 57, but for me, The Searchers is one that really stands out as one of the greats. So maybe we'll have to have you back on at another point, Michael, to debate that John Ford film. We'll get into the rest of our picks for our Sight and Sound Greatest Films Ever Top 10 a little bit later in this segment. But now it is time for a little bit of Massacre Theater. This is where we perform a scene from a screenplay badly, and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week on the show, Josh and I massacred this scene.
You haven't told me everything.
The Atwell woman knew Bryce. She was his mistress. Naturally, Bryce had no idea of her connection with the Soviet agent. We only found out last night after the murder.
Well, then Bryce is in an impossible situation. We should just call in the FBI.
Don't be an idiot. Do you realize the magnitude of the scandal? The Secretary of Defense and a Soviet agent sharing the favors of a murdered whore? David might even be a suspect in the killing.
Yeah, well, I think that's something to consider.
It isn't speculation. Tom Bryce was with me in my apartment at the time of the murder. He couldn't possibly have done it.
Fine, then let's call in the FBI. Let Bryce take his chances.
That decision is not yours to make. What we will do is catch this Yuri ourselves before anyone knows what's happened. After we've got him, we'll handle the rest of it.
You mean the gentleman in the next room?
The man we're after is a spy and a murderer. Would anyone deny that justice had been done?
Yeah, I would.
That's Kevin Costner as Lieutenant Commander Tom Farrell and Will Patton as Scott Pritchard from 1987's No Way Out. Not a film that's going to make anyone's Sight and Sound top 10, I'm guessing. Directed by Roger Donaldson.
But I like that film.
Yeah, I think I do too. It's a fun
spy movie. Was it on your
movie.
No, for 87 maybe.
Written by Robert Guerin. The tie-in, of course, last week we talked about The Bourne Legacy and did our top 5 cinema spies. If you missed that show and want to hear it, you can find it in iTunes. It's episode number 409.
Seth Gross from Santa Monica, California, did some additional dot connecting, though, Adam. He noticed that the movie also features Gene Hackman, who starred in The Conversation, which was your pick for Best Spy Movie.
That's right. I wasn't thinking about the Gene Hackman connection to my list when we picked No Way Out. It just seemed like a fun movie and a fun bit of dialogue to do. Will Patton is so over the top.
Yes.
No Way Out, that it really does make the whole film a delight and that scene particularly fun.
He really puts the evil in snivel.
Doesn't he?
Yeah.
He does. Josh, the Film Spotting hat is not brimming. I'm guessing
we didn't
that
think it was going
to
be.
No, there are a lot of people who still need to see 1987's No Way Out after they get to all the films in our top 10 list here on this show. But reach into the hat, pick out this week's winner.
Winner would be Rick Pierre from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Congrats, Rick. Email feedback@filmspotting.net. We'll set you up with your prize.
Oh, yeah. Makes perfect sense, Nick. I just, you know, I haven't found it yet. I'll get it, though.
Okay, what about your check? I'm there, man. I'm there. I got the dam bursting, the river, everything. You watch. Changing the block, he's really going to open things up for me.
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent foreign and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/Film Spotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
All right, I'm going to have to sit this one out as it's only a two-person scene, but this is a film. It does tie in with our Sight and Sound list, our top 10 greatest films of all time, and that's all I'm going to say about it. I actually think I'm filling the biggest shoes here by playing director.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's something revealing about
heresy.
Your choice of wanting to be director.
You're so
if
right.
People put this together.
You're so right. You've gotten into the darkness of my psyche. Here, Josh, are you guys ready for this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to give you the action, Michael, and action.
Look, I can't put my finger on it, but I sense something strange about him.
Still, I can't think of a good reason not to put back the number one unit and carry on with the failure mode analysis.
No, I agree about that.
Well, let's get on with it.
Okay, another thing. Let's say we put the unit back and it doesn't fail. That would pretty well wrap it up as far as I was concerned, wouldn't it?
Well, we'd be in very serious trouble.
We would, wouldn't we?
Uh-huh.
What the hell can we do?
Well, we wouldn't have too many alternatives.
And scene.
I'm exhausted.
That was some damn tight-lipped,
You guys sold me. I think you should do the rest of the show.
That was
with those voices.
I could.
I mean, that was as heated as one of my parents' arguments.
What a lucky boy you were growing up, Michael. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, August 28th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
There's a poem I read in which a rat becomes the unit of currency.
Yes, that would be interesting.
Yeah, that would impact the world economy.
The name alone, better than the dong or the kwacha.
The name says everything.
Yes, the rat.
That's a scene from David Cronenberg's new film opening this weekend in limited release, Cosmopolis, starring Robert Pattinson. And that got us thinking about David Cronenberg and his body of work, thought it was ripe for a Film Spotting poll question, which you can vote in at filmspotting.net. We want to know simply, how much do you love David Cronenberg? Josh, what are their options?
Every film is brilliant. He's one of the best. Some films are brilliant. He's as good as his material. He's creepy, violent, and weird. And Canadian. I'm not a fan. Or the last one, I think I watched Goldblum turn into a bug once. No opinion.
So basically, if you really don't care at all about Cronenberg, that would be your option. This is kind of a loaded question because as of right now, both Michael and you, Josh, have actually seen Cosmopolis. I have not, as we sit here tonight. But how would you vote in this poll, Michael?
Well, I just want to tell you that at the end of the movie, Adam. No, I'm not going to tell you. I mean, some films are brilliant. This is a dumb question.
It is, isn't it?
I don't like these questions.
Because everyone's going to say
that.
You know, they're all true. I mean, he's creepily violent and weird. Some films are brilliant, and every film is in. You know, honestly, I'd go some films are brilliant.
Okay.
But he is, in fact, better than his material.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I'd go that way, too, but I wouldn't tie it to the material so much. But I do think some films are brilliant. I am not the sort of fan where everything he does is absolutely a masterpiece. Because there are people out there who take him that way.
I'm not passing the buck for this poll question to our producer, Sam Van Halgren, except for one part. He's the one who added, and Canadian. So to all of our listeners listening in the Great White North, blame Sam for adding Canadian to creepy, violent, and weird. We want to know what you think about David Cronenberg. Vote now at filmspotting.net. We also, Josh, have a couple of contest winners to announce. We've had some DVDs the past couple of weeks to give away. Two new Sony Pictures Home Entertainment DVDs, The Raid, Redemption, and Community Season 3 of that TV series. So last week on the show, we posed this challenge. We said, tell us your favorite movie that takes place in a school. We'll pick one of those entries to win the Community DVD. And tell us your favorite movie fight scene. Certainly, The Raid got a lot of notoriety, got a lot of attention for some of its action sequences. So those were your challenges. We got so many entries and so many good entries, it was really hard to wade through. I basically threw up my arms and just picked a winner randomly, Josh. So why don't you tell us who picked the best fight scene, the person who's going to win The Raid Redemption on DVD.
That would be Brian Finch from Riverview, Florida. He wrote, the very first action scene that came to mind occurs in the Park Chan-wook film Old Boy. While this film is not really an action movie, I would consider it more of a psychological thriller. It does contain my favorite action scene in which the main character, played by Choi Min-sik, has to battle his way through a crowded corridor. What makes this scene interesting and unique is the way it's shot, which is like a side-scrolling video game. The fight is one continuous take and is my favorite part of the film by far.
I think that's a great pick, Brian. Congratulations. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your prize. That was a very popular entry as well, as you might imagine. The one that did get the most entries, though, for best fight scene, and I think probably the correct answer, it'd probably be my number one, was the great fight sequence between Keith David and Rowdy Roddy Piper in John Carpenter's They Live. The beating in the alley that just goes on for 10 or 12 minutes at least. I think that is a great pick. But Brian Finch and Old Boy is our winner. The winner of our Community Season 3 DVD goes to Taylor C. in Meriden, New Hampshire. My favorite movie that takes place in a school is Lucas from 1986, starring Corey Haim and Charlie Sheen. Upon my first viewing in sixth grade, this was the first movie I saw that really delved into the darkness of high school, but it still had enough of an uplifting final moment and assured me that a nerd can earn respect from a jock-centric school. Plus, the Charlie Sheen character is an interesting, if distant, precursor to the jock nerd of Troy Barnes, played by Donald Glover on Community, this week's prize. Thank you, Taylor, for that. Lucas only came in once. That was Taylor's entry.
I was going to say, I don't have a lot of memory of Lucas. I don't think I was mature enough at that point. I was still in the Star Wars phase.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed Lucas when it came out. It's not one that probably would have come to mind right away, but I really like Taylor's case for it. So congratulations. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your copy of Community.
Murder's never perfect. Always comes apart sooner or later. And when two people are involved, it's usually sooner. Now, we know the Dietrichson dame is in it and somebody else. Pretty soon we'll know who that somebody else is. He'll show. He's got to show. Sometime, somewhere, they've got to meet. Their emotions are all kicked up. Whether it's love or hate, doesn't matter. They can't keep away from each other. They may think it's twice as safe because there are two of them. But it isn't twice as safe. It's 10 times twice as dangerous.
Murder may never be perfect, but we return to our list of the greatest films of all time with a set of selections that all involve a husband or wife looking to knock off their spouse. And I think they're both pretty close to perfect. Josh and Michael, you guys share a pick here. Mine, though, is Billy Wilder's classic Double Indemnity, which we just heard. Hard to pick one Billy Wilder film for this list, just as it was with Hitchcock and Rear Window. The Apartment, Some Like It Hot, those are the two that rank the highest on the critics' top 250. Sunset Boulevard, of course, belongs in the discussion. And my personal favorite of all those might actually be Ace in the Hole. I think that Kirk Douglas film is my second favorite Billy Wilder movie, but it does all come back for me to Double Indemnity. The hard-boiled dialogue alone is enough reason, I think, to put it on this list. And I thought it was funny listening to Terry Gross on Fresh Air recently. They were remembering David Rakoff, the humorist who just passed away from cancer, and he actually quoted the very memorable bit between Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray when they meet at her house for the first time from Double Indemnity, the whole bit about how fast was I going, officer, that exchange. He said he actually carried that around in his wallet. He just liked it that much. I don't know if he was exaggerating or not, but he would carry it around because he loved that scene so much. I think not only do you have that great dialogue, Barbara Stanwyck is arguably the most sinister, sensual femme fatale ever. And I love the odd, interesting relationship, that friendship between Fred McMurray and Edward G. Robinson in the film. What I think, for me, elevates this movie above just being a great noir film, what makes it a Billy Wilder movie, is my reading of Walter Neff as far less of a dope than he seems to be. I think the mystery here isn't, of course, who the killer is. We know that right from the beginning of the film. It's why. And I think the key scene in the movie is when Walter Neff is talking to Phyllis, to Barbara Stanwyck, and says there's not going to be any slip-up, nothing sloppy, nothing weak. It's got to be perfect. Stanwyck may be the catalyst for this, but this is a guy who has the ambition of an artist. He's trying to pull off something impossible, and if he's going to do it, he's going to try to do it perfectly. He's going to try to do something a normal person couldn't do. He's going to outsmart the system. And Wilder plays with that throughout the entire film with this whole notion of the little man and the big man comes up again and again. And there's a great bit where Edward G. Robinson says to him, finally, that I picked you for the job not because I think you're so damn smart, but because I thought you were a shade less dumb than the rest of the outfit. Guess I was wrong. You're not smarter, Walter. You're just a little bit taller. Neff wants to be a big man. He wants to be this almost Nietzschean Superman-like character, I think. And that ambition, however misguided it is, and it's what drives him to his ultimate downfall. It's also what drives a lot of Wilder's heroes to their downfall and what makes them so fun to come back to again and again.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen this movie in a few years, Adam, and you've gotten me curious to, I mean, I loved it. I always kind of gave the edge in that era to The Big Sleep because it's the most berserkly abstract in terms of plotting. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody can follow that plot. And And
not even Howard Hawks.
No, that's right. No, I mean, famously, there's a body that is never accounted for in terms of, you know, but the repartee that you hear in the best of Double Indemnity is certainly picked up by Bogart and Bacall and The Big Sleep. And that at the time, it was really seen by some as kind of a morally corrupting influence mm-hmm. on American movies,
mm-hmm.
Worse than anything since the pre-code era. And thank God for both movies.
Yeah. What I found over the years, because Double Indemnity is a movie that has come up a fair amount in top five lists, is that when people do go and see it for the first time, they hear me go on about how amazing the film is, they tend to find that they think Fred McMurray is basically unwatchable. Hmm. And his stiffness with the dialogue just doesn't really match Barbara Stanwyck or some of the other performers in the film. I've always argued that actually is what makes that performance so good, is he's so stiff, he's so rigid, he's the insurance man, as he says in the film in the voiceover, no visible scars, he's totally forgettable in so many ways, and that just adds to why he's trying to pull off this amazing crime. So I actually love the fact that he's so stiff and seems out of touch a little bit. I think that works, but I know a lot of people who go see it for the first time, they just can't get past it.
Well, and Wilder was fantastic at bringing out that seedier side of Fred McMurray later in The Apartment, and that's a Fred McMurray performance that most people, if they're new to it, just kind of can't believe it's the same guy
right.
who you had to basically put up with in The Absent-Minded Professor.
Yeah, yeah.
I think The Apartment probably would have been my Wilder, actually. Although I do like how you're killing two birds with one stone here, getting Wilder and film noir. That's nice work.
Thank you. Well, let's go to a completely different genre here, but still in keeping with our larger theme of spouses and murder, or in this case, attempted murder. You guys both picked what I think is probably the best silent film ever, and that's Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans from F.W. Murnau. Josh?
Yeah, even though it's a silent film and you think of it as belonging to that era, I see it really as a transition point in that it's so artistic in new ways for the time and ways that we're still seeing being used in movies that it kind of threw down the gauntlet and said, okay, here's a simple fable, a common story of love and another woman and attempted murder, but we're going to show you how it can be done with the movies. So there's the freeness of the camera that's new that F.W. Murnau brings. There's the use of superimposed imagery
right.
that is so haunting. There's one point where George O'Brien's character has the other woman kind of float behind him as he's thinking of her. And so all of these little touches are the movies themselves in this particular film saying, pay attention to us. We're going to go places. And it's just so exciting to see that. I remember getting to see this film on the big screen. I think we talked at one point, Adam, as we were preparing for the show about how are we going to be affected by these older films we've had a chance to see in restored versions in a theater compared to things we've had to catch up with on video. This was one that I saw on a big screen, and it was really one of those unforgettable experiences.
It was unforgettable for me just watching it on DVD at home for the first time, but certainly I can imagine how great it would have been to see it on the big screen. Michael, why do you love Sunrise?
Oh, I love this film. And you can talk about – this is worth like 1 minute of context. William Fox gives Murnau a carte blanche and an open checkbook to make – a movie that really announces Fox's intentions as a serious film, a backer of important films. And he comes up with Sunrise, and it's not an audience-friendly picture for the time. And when you look at the first Academy Awards that were actually presented in 1929, they still had Best Picture divided into two categories. I think one was called, I'm going to get the wording a little off, but Outstanding Motion Picture, and that went to William Wellman's Wings, which is a very entertaining, you know, World War I flyboy romance. Great fun today. And for, quote, unique and artistic achievement, I think was the wording, you know, Murnau's Sunrise, which is inarguably the greater film, and Adam, it might be the silent era's peak achievement, although I have one other that I like even slightly more. But the idea of murdering one's spouse was in the air then. It was like it's just sort of a weird byproduct of this jazz age kind of hysteric, you know, mood, where, you know, dancing on the edge of a precipice all the time. Dreiser's American Tragedy. You had movies like Sunrise kind of using elements of that, in that you have somebody in a rowboat and will he give in to his demons. And then that film takes the nuttiest turn in that it comes back from the brink of near tragedy and becomes this kind of redemptive story of how these two could actually find a way to fall in love again. And it's largely just because, Josh, as you say, you experience their immersion in the big city, this sort of archetypal, symbolic big city, in the most glorious cinematic way. It's as much of a toy box of cinema as Citizen Kane was mm-hmm. 15 years later.
Hmm.
And, Sunrise will never be for everybody, and I've never seen it projected properly on the big screen, so I'm still waiting for that day.
Well, so far with our list here of the greatest films ever, we've covered Citizen Kane, we've covered a couple of great films involving voyeurs, and now a couple of great films covering murderers or attempted murderers. Our next set of films here involves great screen comedians, and perfectly following the great silent film Sunrise, we're going to go to two of our all-time great silent comedians, Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. Josh, you actually went with the Chaplin film, Modern Times.
Yeah, I know Chaplin isn't regarded when it comes down to these lists and you're forced to choose one or the other, which I don't know why you have to, but I rarely see a list that has both of them. I know that Keaton is generally preferred, but I have to go with Modern Times and Chaplin. There's just so much ingenuity and audaciousness and really pure hilarity in this film that sticks with me. It's essentially about the curse of labor, but he also gets into the societal and technological forces that allow labor to govern our lives then. But I'm picking up on, as I'm talking here, a lot of the movies that resonate with me are the ones where I still see the things they're about applying today. And I think this film certainly applies today. When we meet Chaplin's little tramp for the first time, he's this factory worker who's bent over this assembly line that's going at such a furious pace. No one else can keep up with it but him. Of course, this almost kills him. He gets fired and then he ends up in jail. And it's kind of following his story. And this is all taking place amid the tumult of America after the Great Depression. There's a touch in there that always stands out to me, and it's the feeding machine. I don't know if you remember this, but it's where factory workers will be fed by a machine during lunchtime so that mm-hmm. they can continue to work. And it just makes me wonder what Chaplin would say today when so many of us hardly bother to stop to eat lunch at all when we're at work. We just plow right through lunchtime. So really, really a very funny movie, very inventive movie that speaks volumes today.
The Tribune has a feeding machine.
I'm sure. I'm sure. Well, you did go with a Buster Keaton film instead of Chaplin, Michael Phillips, and that pick is Sherlock Jr.
Yeah, I adore Keaton, and I think he's, his style of comedy, it's like it was invented tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
It's just that particular kind of stoic poetry that he's so wonderful at, and I just love Sherlock Jr. is not feature length, even by, it's I think a 40-minute film. I should know.
Mm-hmm. About 45.
Okay, and I tried for many reasons to kind of come up with something else that would sort of fill it out or fit the mold more, but I don't know. I adore it. I just there's too many people now under the age of 30 who are casually or even more so interested in film that don't know it. So all I can say is go see it and see what you think. It breaks my heart not to have an early Paramount Marx Brothers film on this list in terms of a straight up, comic showcase for a comedian or a comedy team. Chaplin's City Lights for me is probably a greater achievement than Modern Times. I missed it by a whisk or two. I think the last minute of City Lights is the most, you talk about bald emotional manipulation that just nails me every time. But Sherlock Jr. is just purely distilled Keaton genius and slapstick of the highest order ever.
Yeah. Not that we need to decide this now or I'm the right person to make the distinction, but having just rewatched both of these films in preparation for this list, I'm giving the edge slightly to Michael and to Buster Keaton. I think Sherlock Jr. is definitely the grander cinematic achievement. It really blew me away watching it again for the first time in probably about 13 or 14 years. Not only the way he deals with the whole meta-ness of going into the film world, he of course plays a projectionist who wants to be a detective. The gags are amazing. I think some of the action just blows you away when you watch what he's capable of. I think the one that really stands out for me is when he's being chased and the person who's wearing this large outfit opens up their jacket, essentially, and he jumps through the person's stomach into the wall and comes out the other side to hide. It's totally bizarre and nuts, but it's amazing to watch, and you do wonder how he even came up with that. I think the key difference for me, though, is that just in terms of the narrative, Modern Times starts to feel a little bit redundant, where the little tramp keeps putting himself in the same situation where he keeps screwing up on the job and keeps getting arrested. And I just think Sherlock Jr. is maybe a little bit more of a sophisticated narrative.
Well, right? And to be fair, I mean these are very different, containers for
absolutely.
Films. Absolutely. One's 40, 45 minutes doesn't pretend to kind of try to flesh out a narrative, but...
Yeah, you can praise Sherlock Jr., Adam, but you don't have to knock Modern Times. Sorry,
I love Modern Times. I love it. I'm just saying, I think Sherlock Jr. is even better.
Are you anti-communist, Adam?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. In fact, I am, of course, 100% American, Michael. Before we get to my legendary screen comedian pick, let's actually hear a voicemail from another one of our guests. This is Dana Stevens, the film critic for Slate and one of the co-hosts of the Slate Culture Gab Fest. She chimes in with her number one most essential movie.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens. I'm the movie critic at Slate and a friend of Film Spotting, and I'm calling in response to Adam and Josh's request for the most essential film in film history. Exactly the kind of question that I have to lay out some disclaimers before answering, because obviously nothing can be summed up in any one single film, but I guess I'm going to name Buster Keaton's The General, his 1926 film about the love of a man for his woman and his train, as my most essential film. And why is it my most essential film? I think maybe because it contains so much of the future of filmmaking within it. It has some of the most astounding action sequences still for its time, and today they're incredible. It has some of Keaton's best stunts. It was his own favorite of his films. And I just feel like when I'm seeing The General, it's always modern, it's always self-reinventing, and it's always new. So that's my pick for most essential film, and thanks for asking me. All right, bye.
Well, obviously, Dana is coming down on the side of Buster Keaton as well. We're all ganging up on you, Josh.
She hates Modern Times, too.
Yeah, I'm sure she does.
She doesn't like communists.
The General is a fantastic pick, and I think what she says is correct. In a lot of ways, you can look at those early Buster Keaton films as precursors to everything that's followed in terms of action movies. It's all there on display. So, fantastic pick. Thank you, Dana, for your voicemail. To round out our legendary comedian triumvirate, we'll go with someone who's not silent. In fact, he rarely stops talking, and that's Woody Allen.
What's your name?
Allison.
You're like New York Jewish left-wing liberal intellectual, Central Park West, Brandeis University, with the socialist summer camps, and the father with the Ben Shahn drawings, right? And the really, strike-oriented kind of... stop me before I make a complete imbecile of myself.
No, that was wonderful. I love being reduced to a cultural stereotype.
Woody there as Alvy Singer in the great Best Picture winner, Annie Hall, reducing poor Carol Kane to a cultural stereotype. Probably my favorite comedic exchange in that movie, and it's filled with some amazing comedic exchanges. But this is a guy, Woody Allen, who I felt had to be represented on my list. I'm such a fan. I did strongly consider Crimes and Misdemeanors and Manhattan as well. I think those are his other two masterpieces. But for me, it comes down to this film simply being the movie that makes me laugh more than any other film. And it's certainly easy to make the case for this being a distinctive Woody Allen picture. All of his central preoccupations are on display: sex, death, cinema, and the mystery here that we've touched on a little bit throughout our list, this mystery of love. You've got two people in Alvy and Annie Hall who seem so good for each other, but nevertheless famously end up with a dead shark. And that mystery is so hard to articulate that the only way Woody can do it is to come up with that metaphor. And I think that this is another film that explores that theme in really interesting technical ways, many of which have become staples of romantic comedies. But you've got direct address, you've got split screen, breaking the fourth wall, flashbacks. I think it's a very funny comedy, but what Woody's doing technically is using the full cinematic capability to get at something a little bit deeper. So Annie Hall is my pick.
I'm not the biggest Woody Allen fan, but there's no arguing against Annie Hall.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, because at some point I'm going to strap you down Clockwork Orange style and make you watch more Woody Allen films.
I know this is coming.
I mean, I guess my question is there enough cinema in Woody Allen as a director to really, if you want to take the bait on Sight and Sound's kind of strictures about, mm-hmm. What is the film great enough? Is it important or influential enough? Blah, blah, blah.
It's influential enough.
Yeah.
Hasn't every great romantic comedy that followed, from When Harry Met Sally to any Nora Ephron movie, they've all followed the same suit as Annie Hall?
I'm not necessarily arguing with you. And I mean, it's certainly one of the three or four I love the most. It's also, I think, Adam, it might be the first, that film kind of hit at a key time for me. I was like 16. And so, I mean, anybody who would talk to me who was a female, I would drag him to this movie.
Right.
I saw that movie you know, it was the first film I saw probably over the 15, 20, you know, paid admissions mark, you know.
Really? And
yeah, yeah. Because to me it felt like, you know, growing up, I'm entering a grown-up world.
Mm-hmm.
Romantic comedy where I get actually maybe 75% of the jokes, you know, at that point. I laughed so hard the first couple times I saw it. And then by the end, you know, I can't go back to that film very often now because I oversaw it then. So in a way, I just need another few years and then I'll revisit it.
Yeah, maybe so. I think that you might be onto something, though, with the fact that it's probably the first sophisticated comedy that I saw that I felt really smart and felt literate just because I got maybe 75% of the jokes and had to go look up the others.
But I think the one thing we got to watch out for is that there's a certain smugness to a lot of Woody Allen's perspective and sense of humor that gives you that kind of... This, you know, gives it kind of an openly condescending edge. He happens to be so damn funny doing it, mm-hmm, that you don't even really question it. I mean, I love movies like Love and Death too.
Yeah.
It's so heartening to see this guy actually still hit it every third or fourth movie now, well into his 70s.
Right.
Where you get a movie like Midnight in Paris, mm-hmm, that actually works. It's pretty good, and it's a huge hit. And somehow that I find very comforting, you know, because directors in other countries can have those kinds of careers more easily than we afford our American directors.
Mais je ne pourrai jamais vivre sans toi. Je ne pourrai.
We go from one of the best screen romantic comedies, for me, the best screen romantic comedy, Annie Hall, to three romantic dramas, all of which conveniently happen to be French. As you heard there with that number, Josh, you've picked our first but not last musical.
And it isn't a Hollywood musical, which I worried about. I wanted a Hollywood musical on this list. I think we are going to get one later, so I feel good about that. But I did go with The Umbrellas of Cherbourg from 1964. With this film, French director Jacques Demy tries to out-musical the Hollywood musical in a lot of ways, and he pulls it off. So the colors here are brighter. The stars, Catherine Deneuve and Nino Castelnuovo, are more gorgeous. There's even more music. Every line of dialogue here is sung. Yet I think what I ultimately appreciate more about Umbrellas is that within this candy-coated fantasy, there's room for the heartache of the real world, and we don't always get that in musicals, particularly Hollywood ones. Deneuve and Castelnuovo are young lovers, and their initial bliss is interrupted by the Algerian War, which separates them for about 2 years, I think it is. And their separation is probably the definitive train station farewell in the cinema. They do reunite. But even so, the movie maintains a bittersweet note. So like I said, unlike most Hollywood musical romances, this is a story of – it's really about naive young love but as seen through the affectionate eyes of experience.
Well, Michael, for your French romantic drama, you went with a film not quite as bittersweet as The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. It is a Jean Vigo film.
So 1934, La Talante, an absolutely unique – screen romance from a director who died so young. And I guess this film, I don't want to, it's not about what happens in the story. It's much more about this mood and kind of a fatalistic mood of young love and just what life is like on the barges and the rivers of France. And I guess picking this film in a way stands in for Godard's Breathless, which I wrestled with, because it's got the same kind of impudence and devil-may-care approach to telling a straightforward story, whereas Godard was kind of consciously dealing with really riffing on American crime genres and films he loved. Vigo's La Talante, I think, is coming from more mysterious locations, you know, more inside his own heart. And it's just got an atmosphere and a flavor unlike any film I've seen. I mean, the only one really to compare to it is Vigo's own Zero for Conduct, a fantastic film that isn't quite feature length. But though, if you don't know those films, Zero for Conduct and La Talante, I just urge anybody to see them.
Well, here's my quick confession and apology, and that's all it is.
You hate the French.
It's certainly not a challenge to your pick, Michael. As you'll see, I have nothing to articulate against or for La Talante. It happens to be the one film among all of our lists that I have never made it all the way through. I've tried at two different points in my life over the past 5 years to watch this film, and every time I get about halfway through it, and it never grabs me. Mm. The story has yet to grab me, and I'm not seeing the kind of innovation technically that I really felt like maybe it would have to understand why it's put on such a pedestal. It didn't grab me. What am I overlooking?
What are you missing? You're a shallow man. Adam.
Yes.
I mean,
but beyond that,
you know, and I think I will say that it's a film that hasn't lived at the forefront of my movie loving consciousness for decades. It's a film that kind of snuck up on me when I was kind of forced by you guys, forced to compile this cockamamie thing, and I guess I just think when it happened and the way it came out and the fact that it doesn't really it just sort of exists out of time. I find it just pure magic, and it's evanescent. You know, it's like a cloud. You can't pin it down in terms of story. It's not really going for the heartstrings at all. It's much more just about capturing a mood, and I think for a young director, he's very clear eyed about what young love really can be like.
Well, it's one I vow I will complete at some point.
Someday.
I feel like I can't be a quote-unquote actual cinephile unless I make it through Lot a Lot, so that will happen at some point down the road.
I don't love The Searchers, man.
Yeah, okay? That's true. And you should be embarrassed about that, frankly,
fine.
Michael. So
fine.
There you go. My pick here to close out our trio of films that are all French romantic dramas happens to be the last film I added to my list, though it doesn't necessarily mean it's number 10 or in last place, as it might be. It is, though, François Truffaut's Jules et Jim. It's based on a novel by Henri-Pierre Roche, but Truffaut certainly makes this all his own and makes it cinematic. I touch on some of the things Woody Allen does in Annie Hall. Everything here but the kitchen sink is on display in Jules and Jim. Newsreel footage, freeze frames, panning shots, wipes. There's a helicopter shot. Of course, the bicycle sequence really stands out. And even voiceover narration is used in Jules and Jim. And I just find, though, beyond all of the technical matter that's going on in this film, it is ultimately a story about friendship. And the heart that comes through in this movie is what stands out with Jules and Jim. I, of course, failed to mention the great dolly/zoom-in shot that Hitchcock made famous in Vertigo, that Spielberg makes famous in Jaws. We also see that here in Jules and Jim. Jeanne Moreau, though, as the love interest, is Catherine. She's a walking mystery. She is a contradiction. In some ways, I think you can make the case she's one of the first manic pixie dream girls. She's someone who is totally objectified by the two men. She's kind of given no backstory, and she ends up being the downfall, though, of both men. But she also behaves like a man and is a very strong-willed character. At one point, she even dresses up like a man, putting on a mustache. And when she takes issue with the way they talk about women, she protests. And we get that amazing sequence where she actually dives into the River Seine. Ultimately, though, Jules and Jim for me is just a film that makes me smile every time I think about it. Just thinking about those two characters sitting in the cafes, talking about art and big ideas and their aspirations, the bicycle sequence where they're riding along and just enjoying life. I think when you look at the film as a whole, the French, Michael, have a phrase for this type of exaltation of spirit. You're much better with French than I am. Do you know where I'm going with the way they articulate that type of happiness and spirit?
Creme brulee
or joie de vivre.
The joie de vivre,
I think. I feel that way about creme brulee often. What comes through with this movie for me.
It's the warmest wave in the great French New Wave. That's what Truffaut brought to that movement. And you get a warmth off this film that, you know, Godard had no interest in.
No.
And most of the other directors, they're just working in a different temperature.
Mm-hmm.
It's another one I haven't seen for over a decade now.
Really?
Josh, is it a film that means anything to you particularly?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the warmth is key because, in a way, this is another one of these kitchen sink films where everything's thrown in there, like Kane is. Yet that not alone is why it persists.
Right.
We're looking back at it not just to see how these techniques were used, but that there was that emotional resonance as well. Those are the ones that last.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked forever, but have somehow only made it through 5 of our 10 picks for the greatest films of all time. We're going to get to our remaining 5 and talk to a very talented young director about his official Sight and Sound ballot in part two of the show. Michael, can we convince you to stick around?
I have many commitments, Adam, but I'm going to try.
You can't leave us hanging in the middle.
I'm going to try.
In the middle of our list.
He has to finish his list, I think.
That may be it. That may be it. He's probably going back to the drawing board right now. We hope you'll join us as we continue with part two of the show.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.